The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Just to exit where I live, for instance, I have to get my temperature checked. I have to produce the equivalent of a hall pass to allow me out of the compound. I have to show it when I come back in. It's the same thing when I go to my office building. And going all over to malls, it's just this incredible machine that has kicked into gear to do everything from disinfecting, you know, putting out these little mats where you can disinfect the soles of your shoes, to signing in when you go to the bank so that in case you turn out to have, you know, test positive and to have the virus, they can go back and trace the contact you had with all these other people.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 22nd, 2020. Lisa Monaco was Barack Obama's counterterrorism and homeland security advisor in the White House and headed the Justice Department's National Security Division. Sophia Yan is a Beijing-based correspondent for The Telegraph, the British newspaper. She is also the official pianist of the Lawfare podcast. You're listening to her right now play Schumann. Lisa and Sophia may not seem to have a lot in common, but they are both spending a lot of time these days thinking about coronavirus. Monaco managed epidemic and pandemic disease events for the Obama administration, and Sophia is in the middle of covering the ongoing epidemic in China. Lisa Monaco joined me in the Jungle Studio on Thursday, with Sophia joining remotely from Beijing to talk about how the Chinese government has responded, how the Trump administration has responded, and how much worse this is likely to get before it ebbs. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 512, Monaco and Yan on coronavirus. Okay, Sophia, get us started. You are in Beijing. I saw your Facebook post the other day in which you were riding down the street on a bicycle with a mask and complaining about how awkward it is to bike with a facial mask on. What is it feel like on the ground in Beijing and elsewhere in China right now with respect to the coronavirus?
Well, face masks are just one of many measures that the government has instituted to try to contain this outbreak. So the Chinese government has restricted the mobility of hundreds of millions, basically the entire country. So there are restrictions on where you can go, how often you can come out of your housing compound, even what days you're allowed to get groceries. Most parts of China now is required to be wearing a face mask in public areas. And this is really to try to curb this issue of transmission, this virus that has spread in China over the last few months. It's spread really pretty quickly. The epicenter of the outbreak is in Hubei province. It's in central China. And it started before the Chinese New Year holiday, which is the time traditionally when this country of 1.4 billion, you know, people go home for the holidays, just as you would in the US, you know, over the winter. And it's the biggest human migration on the planet all year long. So ahead of this, of course, there was a lot of worry that if people were traveling around, that the virus, the disease would spread even further. So they started putting these lockdowns in place, first in the most affected parts of China, and those curbs have spread around the country. So it's, you know, it's interesting to go around right now. It makes sense, of course, that the government wants people to take these precautions, but it also means when you're going day to day, just trying to get to the office or go buy some apples, get some milk, it can take a long time because A, there's a staff shortage in a lot of places, offices, shops, factories, a lot of them are still closed. And B, because you have to do all these extra checks everywhere, it just takes a lot more time just to exit where I live, for instance. I have to get my temperature checked. I have to produce the equivalent of a hall pass to allow me out of the compound. I have to show it when I come back in. It's the same thing when I go to my office building and going all over to malls. It's just this incredible machine that has kicked into gear to do everything from disinfecting, you know, putting out these little mats where you can disinfect the soles of your shoes, to signing in when you go to the bank so that in case you turn out to have, you know, test positive and to have the virus, they can go back and trace the contact you had with all these other people.
And is it working? I mean, you know, I've been kind of watching U.S. markets, which were pretty prickly on the coronavirus subject a couple of weeks ago, but they're humming along just fine. And you see headlines on a pretty regular basis like, you know, markets chugging along, shrugging off coronavirus fears, right? I just made that headline up, but it could have been in any one of 100 publications. And the implication seems to be, well, they've priced in already whatever is going to happen. And, you know, China's going to get this under control and it's not going to spread too much. So, you know, chill out and watch as prices go up. Do you have the sense that the epidemic is ebbing at this point, or is there a degree to which people outside of China just don't understand how big a deal this is internally, or both?
Yeah, you know, I think it's too early, I think, to call it anyway, you know, either way, because the last week or so, we've had a lot of changes in how China is collecting and confirming cases. And so that means the data is a little bit wonky. You know, they were changing the criteria for what they would consider a confirmed case. So today, for instance, we had a really big drop, just a few hundred cases. And we're coming off days where we had tens of thousands of cases in one day. And that's because of the change in criteria. And what that means is that over the last week or so, that may not fully reflect very accurately what's actually happening on the ground. And it makes sense, you know, for countries early in an outbreak to change how they're looking at this, because a new virus, I mean, this is something that the world is trying to understand. So it makes sense that they are changing how they go about figuring out who is sick. You know, that makes sense in terms of just being able to figure out the initial response. But it's happened enough times, a lot of experts are saying that at least, you know, especially for this last week, it's going to be harder to figure out what the trends are and what that means. And so the numbers are dropping. So it does seem like it's working. But the other problem is that everyone's basically still at home. You know, a lot of the country has not kicked back into gear. So when that does happen, the thinking is that transmission and spread could occur again. So how do you keep this under control, contain this virus under wraps while letting the country get back to normal, which is very important because the economy is clearly going to feel the impact. You know, offices and shops, things like this, you know, shut already for weeks, now maybe over a couple of months. I mean, some of these business owners I've talked to in China are saying that they are projecting zero sales for the next few months all the way through the summer. So this means that if China wants to get the economy back up and for people to at least have a little bit of normalcy to their lives, they're going to have to figure out how to let everyone go back to their regular lives.
All right. So we're going to come back to the on-the-ground situation in a moment. But with that as background, Lisa, I am old enough to remember a period of time long, long ago in the distant past when, A, we had a functioning U.S. federal government, and B, there was an outbreak of a different virus on a different continent, Ebola. And the person who had to manage this for at the coordinating level, the response was you.
Yep.
So how does this situation from a U.S. government, assuming there were a functioning coordinating mechanism in the U.S. government, we'll come to that in a moment, how does this situation compare in your mind to the Ebola situation? What, I forget what year that was, 2014?
2014, yeah. So a few things to note here, and we should come back to the organizational differences because there are a number of departures
sure.
and changes since 2014. But I think it's worthwhile spending a minute or two on the actual difference in the disease issues and the virus issues, right? So we dealt with the Ebola epidemic, which originated in West Africa. And there were a number of things that were going on there that made it both, I think, a different challenge from the one that we're facing today vis-a-vis coronavirus. One, it originated in West Africa. The thing that was so distinct about the Ebola 2014 epidemic is that it was the first time we had seen it arise not in a very, very remote part of Africa. And other Ebola outbreaks had been able to be contained in large measure because they had occurred really outside of population centers. The thing that was really so jarring about the beginning of the Ebola epidemic is that it occurred in West Africa and close to a population center. I remember vividly one of the scariest calls I got in my 4 years as the Homeland Security and Counterterrorism Advisor in the White House. It was a late night phone call from the then head of the Centers for Disease Control, Tom Frieden. And he said, "We've just identified a case, i.e. of Ebola, in Lagos, Nigeria." And that was a very frightening concept.
And just to be clear, that's a frightening concept because Lagos is a city of 10 million people,
right.
11 million people or something.
Right. And one of the most populous cities, if not the most in Africa, some thousand flights a day out of there to, you know, all points around the world. And so the idea that it was in Lagos and a potential jumping off point to the rest of the world was really quite dangerous. You can start to see some parallels now, of course, vis-a-vis coronavirus. But something that was very distinct is that we knew a lot about Ebola. We knew that it was and is only transmissible through very intimate contact with bodily fluids at the height of the infectious point of an individual. So you could only get it by having a very close contact with bodily fluids of somebody who was incredibly sick at the time. Right. So fast forward to today, one of the things that was very, very concerning to me in the last couple of weeks is when we saw a Chinese health official say, I first saw it on Twitter, say, "We believe that the coronavirus may be transmissible during the incubation period." And that has profound implications for the ability to understand and control and trace the extent and the spread. So all of the measures that Sophia was talking about, those temperature checks, well, those are only going to be relevant if, in fact, you can detect if somebody is infected vis-a-vis a fever, right? So there's a number of real differences in terms of how public health officials and global health officials are able to deal with this, because it does look like the coronavirus is actually transmissible during the very and longer incubation period. And so that makes the types of really quite innovative measures that we took to try and contain Ebola, i.e. funneling flights from West Africa to only particular airports within the United States, working with local public health officials to do those types of temperature checks so you could really understand if there were any cases coming in to the United States. Those types of measures may well not be as effective vis-a-vis coronavirus for the reasons I just stated.
On the other hand, there's a factor that I think militates in the other direction, which is that Ebola has a lethality rate among infected people upwards of 90%,
yep.
Whereas coronavirus, we still don't know. Do we have a sense of the, Sophia, do we have a sense of the percentage of people who are contracting it, who are dying of it? It's quite low, right?
Yeah, there are some figures that have been put out by the Chinese CDC, but the issue with that is that a lot of the, there's a paper, for instance, that just came out earlier this week, and it did give a very low case fatality rate. But the issue with that was that a lot of the patients in that sample were more recently counted. So those people haven't seen the disease progress entirely. So it hasn't run its full course, and thus an outcome hasn't occurred yet. And it takes 3-4 weeks for this to kind of run its course through a person who's fallen ill from the virus. So it's hard to say. I mean, the data, it's still pretty new, really, in terms of what is understood about this particular virus. And going forward, you know, some experts think that it's going to be higher, this this mortality rate that we have. But again, it's so hard to tell. In the early days, a lot of what was captured were the most severe cases, people who felt sick enough to go to hospitals. And almost immediately, China's healthcare system was overwhelmed by the influx, the volume of patients that were coming up needing care and seeking treatment. So a lot of people actually who were sick, probably with the virus, were turned away. And I interviewed a lot of those families, and some of their relatives died. And doctors thought that those people had the virus, but they weren't tested and thus weren't counted and weren't treated properly. So the scale of this, in some respects, we don't have the full picture.
Yeah, I agree with what Sophia just said. I think early on, the mortality rate that people were focusing on was about 2%, and roughly in the same range as SARS, right, in the past SARS epidemic that China also dealt with about a decade ago. And there are some folks, I think, who think that some of the information flow within and from China is such that it's hard to tell just how much confidence we should have in that 2% number. And as Sophia indicated, there is some reason to think that it's ticking up. I think the bottom line of this is, and I said this in the piece that I wrote for Lawfare on the coronavirus, we need to be quite humble about what we know at this juncture vis-a-vis the lethality and the incubation period, et cetera, of the virus.
Fair enough. But it's fair to say that the epidemic that you dealt with was a very high lethality, relatively low transmissibility event or organism. And this one is a very high transmissibility and comparatively low lethality, though we don't know how low.
I think that's fair. And the other issue is the mode of transmission is obviously quite important. Right, the fact that this is a respiratory virus, communicable, which we know vis-a-vis droplets, right, through sneezing and coughing, that makes it much more difficult, I think, to address transmissibility issues.
All right, so let's turn to, we've talked a little bit about the Chinese government response. I want to come back to that in a moment, but let's talk about the U.S. government response. Donald Trump said publicly that we're doing just fine and it's all going to go away when it warms up anyway. And Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, suggested this may be good for U.S. manufacturing. I am curious, Lisa, for your sense of, first of all, how the changes in posture to address it that have taken place since you left, but also how are we doing in the preventing what is a clearly epidemic level infection rate in China from spreading here in a way that is more than incidental?
So I'll take this first from kind of a really zoom out posture, right? The administration, the current administration, in my view, has not approached pandemic disease like the coronavirus and other emerging infectious diseases with the type of priority that I think it deserves, because I think pandemic disease is one of the greatest threats to global stability and security that we can face. And we're seeing some of the ramifications of that. Why do I think they haven't placed the right priority on it? There, I think there's a few data points here. One, the budget, which is the best indicia of prioritization. They've historically cut prevention funding to things like the Centers for Disease Control. And although there's some indications that they're changing that posture a little bit in the latest budget, organizationally, they have gutted the structures that have been put in place over time to address things like emerging infectious disease, both in the White House and elsewhere. So that I don't think they're looking at it as on par with other national security and homeland security threats. And that's dangerous, right? Because you can't turn on a dime and be prepared for something that one of the foremost experts in this country on these issues, Tony Fauci, who's at the National Institutes of Health, has said is on the cusp of becoming a pandemic, right? Right now we're talking about epidemic, but it is on the cusp of becoming a pandemic. So you've got to have those structures in place at the front end so that you're not playing catch up all the time. So I think that's I think it's profoundly dangerous that we've kind of backslid from the ability to coordinate a response. And the coordination piece is critical because all think of all the things we've just talked about vis-a-vis Ebola and that you'd want to have in place and be able to put in place should we start seeing more spread here and other places around the world. Those don't involve just one single agency, right? It involves everything from border issues to screening questions to, in some instances, we had a massive deployment of military capability into West Africa to help the Africans control the spread of Ebola. All of these things have to interact and be coordinated. You can't do that with, you know, kind of one in name, what seems to be in name only task force. So the Trump administration has said they've created a corona task force headed by Secretary Azar, the Secretary of Health and Human Services. There was that announcement a few weeks ago, but we haven't seen anything else come from that. We don't know how that's running, what's being done. And, you know, as capable an individual as Secretary Azar may be, he's got a full cabinet agency to run. And, you know, the Department of Defense doesn't take its orders from Secretary Azar.
All right. So just in case people who are listening say, yeah, hindsight's 2020. At the time you left government, I believe it was the first piece you wrote after leaving government was a piece for Lawfare warning about exactly this issue. It's pretty clearly addressed to your successor, who of course has since been removed.
Yes.
I'm curious, you know, but you basically said this is the issue that took us by surprise.
Yeah.
Don't let it take you by surprise.
Yeah.
Is it fair to say that this is not a hindsight issue? This is something the administration, A, should have been – had every reason to know to worry about, including that you told them you got to worry about this?
Yes. And it's actually something we focused on in the transition. So it wasn't only the piece, and you're right, it was the first thing I wrote after leaving government and born of a profound concern of the types of transnational threats that weren't getting attention.
I always assumed that that piece was a public version of a transition memo that you wrote.
Yeah, and transition memo, it was included in transition memos, but it also, importantly, was part of a exercise, right, a tabletop exercise that we conducted with the outgoing administration, national security team, and the incoming national security team. So this was done, I believe, in the last week or two of the Obama administration in January of 2017. And it is a I can't claim credit for doing this. I actually was taking a page out of the Bush to Obama transition, which I also was a part of, because at the time in 2008-2009, I was the chief of staff to a then little-known Washington lawyer named Bob Mueller.
Yeah.
And I participated in the transition of administrations in that role from the Bush administration to the Obama administration. And something that I think President George W. Bush did, he placed a very high priority on this. He directed his team to have a very professional, comprehensive handover. And part of that, and it's something President Obama later talked about that he really valued, and part of that process was sitting down for multiple hours, the incoming and outgoing teams, national security teams, sat down and worked through a series of scenarios, if you will, to say, here's the types of issues we, the outgoing team, faced. Here are some of the issues that were on the table, how we approached them, lessons that we learned, and talked through with their successors to kind of give them the benefit of their experience and their insights so that they're not reinventing the wheel when they confronted these issues.
And you talked about this specifically in those contexts.
Yep. And we did the same thing. So, In my fast forward to 2017, as the Homeland Security Advisor, I was responsible for certain aspects of the transition between administrations, obviously, notably the Homeland Security focused pieces of them. And I organized and co-chaired with my successor at the time, Tom Bossert, a exercise, a tabletop, a series of scenarios where we got in a huge room in the old executive office building on the White House complex and literally sat down side by side with the incoming Trump national security team or those who had been named or kind of anointed as such. And we had all of the outgoing national security cabinet members or their deputies. And we walked through a series of scenarios, and we specifically included a pandemic disease scenario. In fact, it was flu. A new strain of flu was the hypothetical that we worked through, precisely because I was and we were so concerned about this issue. So we've talked about Ebola. The thing, if you talk to Homeland Security experts and public health officials, the thing they are most concerned about is a new strain of flu, precisely because it is so communicable. In fact, I was moderating a panel yesterday at NYU Law School for the Reese Center on Law and Security that I'm a distinguished senior fellow at. And on that panel was Howard Zucker, who is the Commissioner of Public Health for the state of New York. And he talked about the state's approach to preparedness for coronavirus, but he really emphasized that the thing they're most concerned about is flu.
Right. All right. So, Sophia, let's compare this sense of the U.S. government response to the much more difficult problem that the Chinese government has faced and how they've dealt with it. They don't do the whole, you know, peaceful transition of power thing that Lisa was describing, but they do have a precursor to this. Like Lisa had to deal with Ebola, they had to deal with SARS. It's roughly in the same time frame, a little bit earlier. Again, this couldn't have taken them completely by surprise. Their initial response seems to have been to cover it up. And now they have sort of snapped into action. So how would you describe the trajectory of the Chinese government response so far?
So in the beginning, it seems like local officials in China maybe already knew what was going on, but hadn't reported fully to higher authorities. No, it's a bureaucratic system. I mean, it is a one-party system, but the way it's set up is that if you, as a local official, I mean, it's your job to manage your patch. If you don't do that very well, that might mean you lose out on the next promotion. And so that's why you see things like maybe data massaging when it comes to the economy or things like this. So it seems like there may have been some disconnect in terms of how quickly local officials acted, whether it was deliberate or a capacity and experience issue, that's not very clear. Eventually, obviously, the central government did catch wind of this. And there are requirements in China at the local level to report when there are more than five cases up to the national level. So there is a mechanism to be tracking these sorts of health occurrences, where the risks might be. But it did take a few weeks in before China disclosed to the world that it was investigating this new virus. They didn't come until New Year's Eve when everybody was celebrating the end of a decade. And then a few weeks after that, we started to see this really big response, all the lockdowns occur, and the Chinese government at the national level, Xi Jinping himself came out and started talking about this around January 20th. So it took a while for that kind of big response to occur. And in that lead up, the general thinking on the ground is that it was a bit botched, really. Maybe if there were more measures taken early on, we wouldn't be in this particular stage now where the virus has spread so globally. So there was a big outpouring of anger in China. It's really rare to see this kind of response from the public, an outcry, basically a dissent, you know, people upset with how the government handled it. And it really came to a peak when a young doctor, he was only 34 years old, but he had been punished by police in China for warning some of his classmates from medical school. He was working at a hospital in Wuhan and noticed that there was this, something was going on. And he, you know, he made comments to his friends in a chat group and police, you know, gave him trouble for it. So they tried to silence him and he eventually got infected himself and then died. And when that happened, the entire country there was so much anger and so much grief because there was a sense that the government wasn't able to get this under control and that maybe they hadn't acted properly from the start. So there's been a move since then to reframe the narrative. I mean, China clearly at this point wants to call a win. They want the economy to get back on its feet. They want people to go back to their normal lives. You know, and for them, this is a big issue of stability going forward, because if the central government isn't able to be seen as having a hand on this situation, it just, you know, they're going to lose the hearts and minds of 1.4 billion people. So, you know, the challenge for the government is there, and they are definitely trying to repaint this picture. Now, the propaganda you see is in state media is about, you know, heroes, medical staff on the front lines, how China's doing everything that it can, and how they're just, you know, building new hospitals. I mean, it's definitely this sense that they're trying to project they've got it under control. And certainly these containment measures so far seem to have worked, but we run into the same problem again. Once they start letting people go back to work, go back to school, there might be infections elsewhere. And we've already seen that piecemeal because a few places have been allowed to open up shop again.
And when you say they've tried to change the narrative, do you have the impression that the anger has abated in response, or was the anger, expressed anger following the death of the doctor, which, you know, was national news here or two, is that still there and that was just the sort of spasm of expression of it, but in fact the government has really sort of lost some prestige here and is actually facing significant public discontent as a result?
There's always a bit of distrust between people in China and also with the government. And I think this was one example where it was like the perfect storm that brewed. I mean, people are still upset about it. Those comments, you know, some things were allowed through, but the censors, the government censors are still taking things down. You know, there was a call for freedom of speech that was trending on the internet here, and that's all been taken down. That's clearly not something that the Chinese government wants to allow. So there's a lot of controlling over how this anger is expressed. What's interesting is that they let it happen in the first place. And I think there was a bit of a pent-up energy, a lot of people frustrated with what was happening. It was unclear, it was confusing, it was scary. I mean, people even now are worried about it. You know, there's a little bit of return to going about your regular life a little bit. There's a little bit more traffic, for instance, in Beijing, but there's still worry. And a few weeks ago, that was even more pronounced. So I think there probably was a bit of a release that needed to happen. And that seems to have occurred. Now the government is just trying to arrest control of the situation and make clear that they've got it under control. The numbers are decreasing. They're discharging patients. Don't worry, China's got your back. You know, this kind of, it's what they always say. And they're just going back to that now. And I think if the Chinese government is messaging in this way, they must feel fairly confident that they do have it under control, however that might be. You know, maybe that means sweeping a little bit of this under the rug and then messaging a certain way. But again, this is this is a disease. If China doesn't manage well, it will have impact around the world. So even if they try to claim a victory before it's time, I don't think that they can hide it, if that makes sense, in a very big way, because this could keep spreading.
Lisa, when Sophia describes the Chinese response, she's describing a remarkable array of authorities that our government simply doesn't have, right? And on the other hand, our government does have reasonably robust authorities, although not the authority to tell, you know, 500 million people stay in your houses and we'll check your temperature if you come out. What are, broadly speaking, I mean, there's already been some controversy over the use of some of these tools. But broadly speaking, if you're the Trump administration now and you've got, you know, I don't know, 29 or 30 cases that have shown up in the United States, what are your tools to contain the thing?
So broadly speaking, there are actually quite significant authorities that largely happen at the state level, right, in the state and local level. And actually, we've seen some of it be deployed in the past and some very recently vis-a-vis coronavirus. There was the first, I think this is right, the first large-scale quarantine since the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic just happened out in California, specifically to contain the potential spread of a number of people who'd come back from China. And so these folks were held on a military base, I believe, in California, having arrived from China, so as to make sure that they could not transmit the virus, during the incubation period. And so that got a lot of attention because it was significant and had not occurred, as I said, since the 1918 flu epidemic. So there are public health authorities that can be triggered to do that type of containment or quarantine. But our system, as you rightly point out, seeks to try and balance what is the least restrictive measure. Largely, that's the principle to apply that you can apply in order to effectuate the public health. The Health and Human Services Secretary has the capability to trigger a certain kind of emergency authorities to speed up development of countermeasures. If one could deploy, you know, particular kind of drugs or vaccine development and the like, and those are types of things we also did during Ebola. So, because of our federalism system, what you see is these things actually being done really redound to the states and to the local public health officials.
Although one thing that we have that the Chinese government, at least to my knowledge, does not have is the Center for Disease Control. And it's not that they don't have some parallel organization.
But they do.
The CDC is a genuine sort of logistical and intellectual kind of powerhouse that I don't think there are analogs to it at that level of excellence elsewhere. Is that fair?
So there is actually a Chinese CDC. There is a Chinese Centers for Disease Control. And if you know the public health experts here, I think quite highly of the Chinese CDC, again, operating within its system and its constraints. You know, I'm less clear on what their broader deployment capability is, right, within China. But look, this is a country that just built a hospital in 2 weeks,
right?
So there's a capability there that is something that I think we'd be hard-pressed to, you know, somebody I was talking to recently said, you know, you couldn't begin to even get the permitting for the potential land options for a hospital like that in 2 weeks. I mean, it's kind of inconceivable in our system that you'd be able to get that done. And we saw that hospital go up literally in a couple weeks' time.
Sophia, what do we know about the Chinese CDC? Are they any good?
They seem to be doing the best that they can. They are working now with the World Health Organization, I believe, to review some data and to collect information. They've done a lot of exchange programs with different countries, and they seem to be pretty well respected. They've put out a lot of papers in terms of data, but in terms of dealing with this kind of epidemic, I mean, it's unprecedented. It's a country of 1.4 billion people. It's a virus that clearly transmits pretty quickly and easily. So any country dealing with something at this scale, I mean, it's just certainly a big challenge. You know, I think the Chinese government response highlights kind of something that only the Chinese can do, which is to put all these restrictions in place, build hospitals in a few days. You know, they've been chartering some flights even to fly migrant workers back because of all these quarantine restrictions. A lot of people can't travel. Also, flights and rail links canceled around the country. So there's this very big mobilization effort to deal with the outbreak. And everybody's pretty much on board with it. I mean, there's a sense, there's a little bit of frustration with some Chinese here who have to deal with these new restrictions on life in terms of going out and getting your temperature checked and getting stopped on the street, things like that. But for the most part, people are pretty resigned to it. You know, and it's a very confusing time in a way for the Chinese. You know, I said before, there is a bit of distrust in the government that exists. But you also have to remember that these are people who've been told their whole lives that the Chinese Communist Party will do everything for them, that they've got their back. And now you have this situation where people still do remember SARS, and maybe they think that they will see that again. So it's a very complicated feeling for the Chinese on the ground. But in terms of the government being able to kick everything into gear and get everybody to do this, I mean, it's just incredible to see. There are banners, propaganda banners all over the country that normally would talk about how great the party is. Now they're telling you to wear a mask. And there's one that I just saw the other day. It said it was important in reminding people to spot signs early and to report if you were sick early, because the sooner you did that, the sooner you'd be cured and the sooner you would feel healthy again. And so this kind of sentiment, I mean, this sort of way to get everybody to behave a certain way, I think, is something only the Chinese can do because of their political system.
So there's a video that's been circulating on social media of an elderly woman walking in a public space in China and without a mask, and a drone flying by and screaming at her, "Put on a mask." And I cannot verify that the thing is real, but is the implication of the video is that there's a, you know, the surveillance apparatus on compliance with the rules is incredibly tight. Is that generally fair?
Yeah, there's some overzealous local officials, it seems, who are trying very hard to play by the rules. The interesting thing, I think, pulling back a little bit from all of this, is that it is the Chinese surveillance apparatus that has been able to help with so many of these containment measures. I mean, there are instances where after someone who had tested positive, the authorities were able to trace back down to the specific time this person was on public transport and then inform all those other people. I mean, there are maps and apps that the government has built now that you can go on, you can put in your information and check to see if you had come in contact with anyone who had tested positive. I mean, it's really incredible, this kind of Big Brother-esque way of life that can have a potentially good impact in terms of the sort of health emergency response. And I think for the Chinese in the long term, it seems likely that they may call this all a win and reason for actually more draconian measures on people, because this to them is an example of why it's a success and why it's needed. So it's been really interesting to see it happen. People are sort of used to it, I guess, in a way.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because I've always found it interesting that, you know, in almost all public policy areas, the word surveillance has a negative connotation. The one area where people use surveillance as an unambiguous positive is public health arena, where they talk about surveillance as a good thing. And this is those two worlds colliding, where you actually have the surveillance state using surveillance in the most negative sense of the term for public health surveillance in a way that is not wholly negative.
All these masks are going to really mess up the facial recognition and AI algorithms.
color me devastated. All right. So, Lisa, you were talking before about the structural lack of functioning of coordinating mechanisms in the U.S. federal government and their impact on an environment like this. So, like, bring that down to brass tacks for a minute. Like, what do you mean by that in real terms?
So, give you two concrete examples of that. You referenced the job I held as White House Homeland Security and Counterterrorism Advisor. That job was created after 9/11 to have one person in the White House focused 100% of his or her time, 24/7, on issues like terrorism, cyber threats, pandemic disease, natural disasters, things that have a direct and immediate impact on the homeland. The National Security Advisor focuses on national security and foreign policy issues. But after 9/11, President George W. Bush thought it important to have a senior person in the White House directly and immediately accountable to him on these transnational threat issues with a direct impact on the homeland. So he created the Homeland Security Advisor. President Obama saw the wisdom of that role and kept it, and I occupied it for the entirety of his second term.
And what was your nickname in that capacity?
My nickname was Dr. Doom. And as the portfolio implies, I did not have a lot of good news to deliver him every day, and I met with him every morning, and I rarely had any good news to give him. So that's how I got that nickname. But the point of the role was to have somebody who has a responsibility to be thinking about these issues every day, and when something really bad happens, to coordinate the government's policy and other responses to it. And in the case of Ebola, that, as you pointed out, that was my role. But I also had lots of other things on my to-do list throughout that time. It was also the time when ISIS was on the rise. Any number of things were going on. So the president also ended up appointing an Ebola response coordinator, Ron Klain, who did a fantastic job. And at the end of all of the when the Ebola response got under control, et cetera, Ron said to the president, you should never have to appoint another kind of disease czar. And he recommended that there be a unit inside the National Security Council, a pandemic preparedness unit that is focused on these types of issues, whether it's flu, whether it's Ebola, whether it's coronavirus. And so we set up a structure where we had a global health security entity and unit within the National Security Council, just like we have one for counterterrorism, like we have one for cyber issues. And that is a structure that was put in place to be constantly thinking about these issues and preparing for them. Those two issues, the Homeland Security Advisor role, this pandemic preparedness unit within the National Security Council, those have both been dismantled in the last 3 years. So the role that I occupied and that President George W. Bush had somebody in that role for all 8 years of his presidency, President Obama had that role filled for 8 years. That role has now been erased. You can't name a little quiz for you, Ben. Can you name the Homeland Security and Counterterrorism Advisor?
No, I'm aware that your successor, Tom Bossert, was dismissed, or and my impression is that it has not been filled since. Is that right?
Effectively, it hasn't. I think they had a person function at the deputy level at one point, but I think it's now been erased. Right. So you don't have somebody who is at the most senior level in the White House who's talking to the president every day about these issues. And more importantly, you no longer have this pandemic preparedness unit within the White House. That's been dismantled. The very capable Rear Admiral Tom Zimmer, who had occupied that role, was reassigned a couple years ago, and that unit has been disbanded. So you don't have the kind of the arm of government, the kind of engine of government, the experts, the subject matter expertise resident in the National Security Council focused on these issues 100% of the time, even though we've got those things for other threats, right? Terrorism, cyber, you name it. And pandemic disease is something that very knowledgeable and thoughtful folks believe is the thing that will kill the most people in the shortest amount of time over the next 10 years.
Sophia, if I were the Chinese government right now, in addition to putting together Lego hospitals and and seeking to, you know, manage 1.4 billion people's movements and interactions with one another, I would also be super sensitive about information flows because they are dealing with this apparent discontent among large numbers of people and eruptions of expressed anger. They recently expelled a bunch of Wall Street Journal reporters, which is, you know, a move they do periodically. And I'm curious to what extent that is or is not connected to this larger environment in which they're operating.
Yeah, that expulsion, China expelled three Wall Street Journal reporters. They've got 5 days to get out of the country. And it's conveniently killing a lot of birds with just one stone. Part of it is in retaliation, you know, to the world outside of China, to what the U.S. announced a few days ago, which was that it decided it would treat five major Chinese state-run media organizations basically as an extension of the Chinese government, requiring them to disclose information to the State Department about what they're doing in the U.S. But at the same time, China, remember, is dealing with this public anger issue at home about the government's response. So there is the sense that this move to expel the foreign reporters is a way to distract, and it's a way to redirect public anger over how the Chinese government handled or is handling the epidemic to stoke this anti-foreign, very nationalist sentiment at home. And it's something that they've been kind of, you know, fanning for a while. China says it was upset about this opinion piece that the Wall Street Journal had published. It had a headline that was, quote, China is the real sick man of Asia. And if you go around in China, a lot of people, they will talk about this. They know that this headline was published by an American newspaper. And so they have done a lot of messaging, the Chinese government, about this particular issue. And so by kind of putting this blame, you know, saying, hey, we're trying the best we can, but, you know, outside world, you're just poking holes at us and you're hurting us when we're already on the ground. You know, it's like a bit of a wounded animal reacting. And I think it's a way to distract from how people here are feeling, because they can harness that energy of people being upset to this other issue that's kind of a tried and true one that China falls back on all the time, us versus them. So, you know, it's interesting to see how it's all played out, because they were very public about it. What's different about this expulsion compared to other ones that we've seen more recently of foreign journalists is that China announced it very clearly. They did it at the daily press briefing that the foreign ministry holds. So they wanted the world to know. I mean, often they simply just don't renew your press accreditation. So it's not a very public, very loud affair. It's just something that happens. And they just kind of, you know, they're like, oh, well, you know, time's up for you. You know, and so this is very different. They clearly wanted to make a statement. And I think it does different things. It accomplishes different goals for China at home and abroad.
As Donald Trump would say, we will see what happens. Sophia Yan, Lisa Monaco, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Hey, y'all, we need you to tweet about the Lawfare podcast. Share us on all manner of social media. I hear there's this new TikTok thing. Don't think there are any TikTok videos about the Lawfare podcast. I think you should get on that. I also think you should rate and review the Lawfare podcast on whatever podcast distribution services you use. You should, and I mean should, get Lawfare swag at the Lawfare store. You should also exist in eternal gratitude to Jacob Schultz, our audio engineer this week, and to Jen Patya Howell, who, as always, produced and edited the Lawfare podcast. And this week of all weeks, you should feel indebted to Sophia Yan, who not only was our guest, but is playing the music to get us out of the Lawfare podcast. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.